Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it's Wednesday, October 19th, 2016. I'm Jeff Tiberi. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. On this episode, I believe it's episode 25, we're jonesing on the General Assembly. Republican state lawmakers have held supermajorities there for the past 4 years, providing them with wide policy flexibility. Democrats are now making a run at cutting off one of those veto-proof majorities, and coupled potentially with a change at the executive mansion, they could shift the legislative direction of the state for at least the next 2 years. In studio today to talk about the Republican strongholds and what might be in play over the next few weeks is Jason DeBruin, our relatively new data reporter. Jason, hello.
Nice to be here. Hey, thanks for having me. And I wouldn't say relatively new. I'd still say brand new. It's only been less than 2 months, so still fresh out of the box.
Jason comes over to North Carolina Public Radio from the Triangle Business Journal. We'll chat a little bit more about that later in the podcast. But let's start with the General Assembly. There are 170 seats, 120 in the House, 50 in the Senate, some of which are being contested, some of which are not.
Many of which are not.
You looked at these seats to find out what's in play, what's competitive, the rematches. We'll get into, you know, some of the more nuanced stuff in a moment. But tell us about the top line of what you looked at and what you found.
Yeah, I mean, so in general, we thought, okay, look, there's 170 races. That's too many to try to digest all at once. So let's break this up into the ones that are actually in play, the ones that are going to actually make a difference. There's a ton of uncontested races. There's even more where it's highly unlikely that the candidate of one party or the other is going to win. And that cuts both ways. I mean, Democrats, Republicans, there are races where it's just highly unlikely that one of the parties is going to lose because of the makeups of that district. Gerrymandering plays a factor, but so does just the geography of the district. So we wanted to say, all right, how many races are actually in play? Where are the parties spending their money? Where are candidates really spending a lot of time? Where's the most campaigning happened? And then let's sort of tailor our coverage to focus on those races.
Okay. Quick context for the listeners. 120 seats in the House. At this point, 74 are held by Republicans, 45 by Democrats. There's one independent. And in the Senate, 34 seats are held by Republicans and 16 by Dems. We should note that majorities are not at risk here. Republicans will retain majorities in both chambers when the General Assembly reconvenes in January. But a little bit more about these competitive seats. What is the more nuanced snapshot of what has to happen? Well, let's start with this. Which supermajority is more in play or more at risk from based on what you saw and what has to happen for it to be undone?
Yeah, the one that's in play is the House, or said another way, the one that's essentially not in play at all is the Senate. Republicans hold a very strong grip on the different districts that would even potentially be in play. So in order for Democrats to break a supermajority in the House would be quite a tall order indeed. You know, you hesitate to say impossible, but it's about as close to impossible as it could be. In the House, there's some opportunities. There's maybe in the neighborhood of 15, 16, maybe a few more races, depending on who you talk to, that are actually in play. And as you know, the Democrats need to only flip 4 seats in order to wrestle away that supermajority. Of course, the supermajority being that 3/5 majority where you can override a veto. So we ended up spending a little bit more time looking at some of those House races just because the Senate races are such a tall order for the Democrats to break.
So these seats that the Dems would need to flip or areas where they could pick up, I think they have to net 4 seats, as you mentioned, in order to crack into the supermajority. Where are those seats? Tell me a little about those.
Yeah, it's a good point. And let me first maybe make the point, accentuate the point you just made, which is they do need to net 4 seats. You know, I think we've heard a lot about picking up four, but at the end of the day, if they lose a seat, well, then they need to pick up 5 new ones, right? I mean, that's sort of the way the math works. So,
and one, I'll just cut you off rudely for one moment. One interesting seat, and you mentioned this at some point, you've had 3 web stories out about this this issue, and you were on the State of Things yesterday on WUNC, and you were talking about a seat in Wake County, Cary. I mean, Gail Adcock is a one-term incumbent, and she ousted an incumbent 2 years ago, and that incumbent is running against her. So just to the point, I mean, those names might not mean a lot to a lot of people, but there are seats.
No, it's a really interesting, and it's a great case in point of sort of what's going on across the state, because like you said, 2 years ago, Tom Murray held a seat. I think he was pretty well liked within the party. Gail Adcock, who works at SAS, very beloved amongst the SAS community. She's the head of their health services organization over there. And if you don't know about it, I encourage you, any listeners, to learn about it. It's a really interesting concept they have over there. Basically, they offer a full broad range of primary and even some specialty healthcare services to their employees. Basically, they've said, you know, if we can offer you healthcare here, we can sort of keep our own costs in check. Anyway, she heads all of that up, so that's getting a little sidetracked. But the point being that, you know, a lot of people like her. She won literally by one of the slimmest of possible margins, 51-49% a couple years ago. Now she's being challenged. And certainly that seat is one that is potentially in play. I mean, when you're talking about a near 50-50 split, certainly that's one that could be up for grabs again this year.
So it's largely urban areas that we're talking about, Mecklenburg and Wake County. And from my understanding of it and chatting with you and strategists and political scientists and, of course, lawmakers, a lot of this has to do with the in-migration, folks coming from elsewhere in the country, a lot of independents, a lot of unaffiliated voters, and the populations are changing in the state, and that's one of the main reasons that some of these seats are in play. They're growing, and there are a lot of outsiders. But Mecklenburg and Wake, any other areas to really note when it comes down to talking about House seats that are in play?
One interesting that I might reference is out in the mountains. I didn't think that was an area that is so in play, but there's a couple districts out, even Asheville and then west of Asheville, where the races weren't quite as close as you, or excuse me, were closer than you might have guessed them to be a couple years ago and even 4 years ago. But yeah, primarily the lion's share of the races that are in play, Wake County, particularly in some of the suburban areas of Wake County, that being North Raleigh, out towards Cary, Apex area. And then the same is definitely true for Mecklenburg. There again, you're looking at some of the suburban areas down towards Matthews, Mint Hill, and what have you.
So let's play it out. Democrats do not net 4 seats come November 8th. What does that mean?
Well, it could set up a pretty gridlocked situation, if you will, because you would have supermajorities in the House and Senate, but if Roy Cooper wins, you would have a situation where you have, obviously, the opposing party in the executive mansion. What we could end up seeing a lot of, now this is no guarantee, but we could end up seeing a lot of is legislation, conservative legislation passes House, passes Senate, hits Cooper's desk, quick veto, but with those supermajorities, they can override that veto, and you might see that happen a lot. Now, that's what happened a lot in 2011 and 12. You'll remember the Republicans took strong majorities in both the House and the Senate, but governor was still Bev Perdue.
You actually had a Democrat for those.
Beverly Perdue, the Democrat that was still, you know, she wasn't up for election at that point, so it was in the middle of her term. In that 11-12 biennium, there were 19 times that she vetoed a legislation that came across her desk, which is, you know, well above normal.
That's a lot.
It's definitely a lot. Yeah, I mean, 19 might not sound like a lot, but it absolutely is a lot. And of those 19, 11 were overridden. So you're talking about more than half, which is significant. Now, that's not to say that vetoes and overrides don't happen even all within the same party. Under Pat McCrory, there were 6 vetoes and 4 overrides. But just you know, that sort of accentuates the point. 4 years of Pat McCrory, 6 vetoes. Only 2 years under Bev Perdue, 19 vetoes. I think it's pretty fair to say that if the supermajorities hold, and if Roy Cooper wins, it'd be a lot closer to that 19 number every 2 years.
All right, flip the coin. Democrats net 4, at least 4 seats come November 9th, and Roy Cooper is the next governor of North Carolina, the 75th governor. Then what?
Then you'll have, I mean, utter absolute gridlock. You'll have kind of what you have up on Capitol Hill these days, because you'll have the Senate controlled by Republicans. You'll have the House not controlled by Republicans, but certainly not with an override power, and you'll potentially have a Democrat in the executive mansion. So you'll have legislation that, say, easily passes the Senate, passes in the House, if not easily, at least with a comfortable margin, heads on up to the governor's desk, he slaps a veto on it, goes back, Senate overrides, and then you get stuck in the House where they don't have enough to override, and boom, it falls flat and nothing happens.
All right. So me, as the grizzled, cynical, negative, grouchy, grumpy political reporter, will offer the hint of optimism here. What's to say that if that second scenario plays out, if Democrats eliminate one supermajority and Roy Cooper is the next governor of the state, what's to say they won't work together and compromise and get all sorts of things done?
Yeah, that is certainly the optimistic viewpoint. Just with the tenor, not only at the state level, but certainly that's coming down from the national level, I hesitate to think that there will be much compromise. Now, look, all right.
That's very fair.
Look, right. I don't want to sound so jaded as to suggest that we might as well not even have session, right? I mean, certainly there will be legislation that's passed. New laws will come down. Things are going to happen.
Functionally, they have to do things.
Functionally, things are going to happen.
Right.
I mean, what everybody remembers, it's been several years now, but the federal government shutdown that lasted several weeks, something like that, I don't think could happen in North Carolina. Though we saw just recently where the budget was extended, and it's funny, this is when you had Republicans controlling supermajorities in the House and Senate and a Republican governor, and they still couldn't come to an agreement on a budget and had to delay that more than a month.
You're talking about 2015 when we had the longest legislative
session
in 14 years,
it's
despite
crazy.
Republicans controlling everything.
That's exactly right, and they still couldn't come to an agreement. Now, and look, let's not have short memories. It wasn't that long ago when Democrats controlled all three phases, if you will, and could also not
all
agree on it.
All sorts of infighting.
So,
all sorts
look,
of, sure.
This happens no matter what the party. This happens no matter what the year. The only point being, if there's that much fighting within an individual party, just imagine how much fighting there's going to be. But, all right, let's flip this on its head and say that if there's that much fighting within the party, maybe there's potential for compromise and reaching across the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
Again, don't let me be so jaded as to pretend that that's not possible. Certainly it is possible. But
they have to pass a state budget. That is the big thing.
Sure.
That has to happen in the long legislative session. And
Look, schools will be funded. Medicaid is going to be funded. DHHS is going to be funded. I mean,
Medicaid is a fascinating one in that Governor McCrory, obviously, he and the General Assembly elected not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Some Republican governors did. Roy Cooper, the candidate, the attorney general running to replace Pat McCrory, has criticized the governor for that. It will be interesting to see, again, if Cooper wins. And this race, we should note, is still a toss-up, is still within a couple of points. Any number of things could happen. But playing this line of conversation out, if Cooper becomes governor, I'll be interested to see how much of an issue he makes Medicaid or how much pressure he tries to put on the legislature to do something with it or expand part of it. Because my understanding of it is the governor cannot act unilaterally and just say, wave a wand and say, we're going to give, Medicaid to however 200,000-300,000 people that would be eligible for it.
That's true. Exactly. It does need to still go through the full legislative process. And I would consider it pretty unlikely that a Medicaid expansion would be approved in either of the chambers as currently constituted. My comment to talk about Medicaid was more to point out that, we're spending $13 billion dollars North Carolina and the government, and the federal money combined is in the neighborhood of $13 billion. That's not going to go to zero or even down to 12 or 11 billion. I mean, the programs that are in place, the schools are not going to all of a sudden shut down. I mean, things are absolutely going to happen. In fact, I think it's pretty fair to say that the average life for the average North Carolinian, if you had no idea that an election even happened, very little would probably even change.
Right.
But you wouldn't see like the earned income tax credit would not all of a sudden come back. You would not have income taxes that all of a sudden are raised and sales taxes that were implemented a couple years ago going away. I mean, these kind of broad sweeping plans that sort of are linked to an ideology, all of that would kind of just the ship would continue to go forward and maybe see again in 2 years.
Jason De Bruin is chatting about supermajorities and seats in the General Assembly here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. What other takeaways, what else did you learn from this series of stories, these stories that you did over the past week or so, if anything of note?
Yeah, no, absolutely. One of the things that was sort of, I don't want to say comical, but was kind of interesting to me was to look at where we had some legislative rematches. And just kind of a little weird thing that was stuck in the back of my head. It just got me kind of curious, hey, where are we seeing an exact rematch from 2 years ago? And it's funny, you know, going into it, my thinking was that I was probably going to see contests where the rematch was a very close outcome from a couple years ago. I didn't really say that very well, but the point being, I would imagine that if you lost by a narrow margin 2 years ago, maybe you think you can swing a couple hundred or even thousand votes this year. Boom, you got a better shot at it. If you lost by a big margin, why bang your head against the wall again? Well, it turns out to be the exact opposite. The rematches tended to be those races where a couple years ago, it was just one party taking a significant portion of the vote over another party. And in some of my reporting, what it really struck me as is found that essentially the rematch occurred because the losing party couldn't find anybody else to run, and the party in that area, the local party affiliate, didn't want to just simply concede the district. And it kind of makes sense because, you know, if you're a strong party advocate, maybe you're the chairman of your county's affiliate or whatever, you're looking for somebody to stick their neck out there and kind of realize that they're very unlikely to win, but still want to make sure that a seat isn't just completely conceded. And yet no one in your area wants to step up and I don't want to say waste their time, but, you know, really attempt at winning a seat. So it sort of falls back on the person who did it a couple years ago to, step up to the challenge. And even if they don't think they're going to win, go ahead and try to at least fight and make sure that party is represented. Here again, cuts both ways. Democrats lost. There are certain districts where Democrats lost big, and that's a same challenger. There are certain districts where Republican lost big 2 years ago, and they're stepping back up to do it. So that was pretty interesting to me.
Jason De Bruin chatting legislative districts. JD, do they call you JD?
There are some people that call me JD. Some people call me J-Bird. I like that. A lot of people just call me J. Most often I just get J.
All right, fair enough.
But I like JD. Feel free to call me that if you'd like.
We're going to throw some curveballs at you. Uh-oh. That you have no idea are coming point, because keeping it fresh is really the only way to keep it.
On the politics podcast, for sure. Yeah, it's fresh.
You got to. month and a half since you were at the Triangle Business
six
Journal.
Weeks, basically.
Newspaper, online journalism, print journalism to radio. What's been the biggest difference from your perspective as a reporter so far?
Just the pace. It struck me that on the print side is a little bit more, you're on the hamster wheel and you're always kind of chasing the next breaking news story. So it's like, what's next? What's next? But the nice thing about radio is that, look, certainly we want to break news. It's not like we're conceding anything, but it is a little bit more of a sort of, let's put everything in context. We're going to give people some information on your morning drive that, you know, maybe you saw in a headline or a push notification last night, but we're going to try to put that in a little bit more context for you. Whereas on the print side, I think too often you get a breaking news, and then once you've broken that story, you're on to the next breaking news, and you never really go back and sort of clean up the news story that you broke yesterday. So that's been a really nice change of pace and something I've really enjoyed, because I've always sort of considered that a bit of a shortcoming of print journalism in general, and then, you know, to be honest, my own reporting, just because that was the medium. So that's been the biggest change of pace and one that I've liked. Though I do have to say, there is a part of me that misses that hamster wheel. It's kind of funny to say. It's sort of a grass is always greener situation, I think. But there is a part of me that misses that, you know, on the front lines, cracking news, talking to sources, and you know, really getting out there first with something.
Okay. Over under 100 goals in your soccer career.
I'd have to go under on that one, unfortunately. I played soccer, still play soccer for many years. I started when I was, you know, just a really, you know, 3-4 years old, could barely walk. It might be right around 100, but I mean, for all the different seasons I've played, that's not very many. It's going to sound like a cop-out excuse, but I never played forward. I'm kind of a tall guy. I'm about 6'3", 6'4", which is good for what I'm trying
with shoes on.
With shoes on, yeah, with shoes and a hat. No.
You're tall, dude.
Yeah, I know, I'm tall. It's good for winning headers. So I think I scored probably more goals off corner kicks headers than anything, but you don't get as many opportunities that way. And the downside of being kind of lanky is that I'm not quite as fast. So oftentimes I'd get outrun if there was a breakaway or something like that. So I stuck to the middle of the field, received the ball, shielded off a defender, and then played a through ball to a speedier forward who might go in and put it away.
Most memorable venue you ever played at, soccer-wise, if anything kind of rises to the occasion? I'm not a big soccer guy.
Sure.
Might be a weird question.
I haven't played in any iconic places, to say the least. I played at Liberty for a little while. I'm going to say that that's the most memorable simply because the view was so beautiful. The field, if anybody's familiar with the campus, it's in Lynchburg, Virginia. And the whole campus is literally built on the side of the mountain. And the way the field was situated, it almost like jut out a little bit. So you could see for miles. So it was really beautiful. Here in North Carolina, I'd have to say Bryan Park. It's in Greensboro. Listeners out that way, I'm sure, are familiar with it. Fantastic facility. Well kept. The grass is perfect. And always had good games out there because the ball would roll true and smooth. And it was always a great place to play.
Sock game.
Sock game. I love a sock.
Tell me about it.
This is the new.
How many pair? What do you go ahead?
Oh gosh, a couple dozen probably. I've got socks with mustaches, socks with cars. I got a pair of socks with an iguana eating a hamburger. Right now, I'm wearing a sock. I'm not kidding you not. I'm wearing a sock with a monkey who's riding a skateboard, wearing sunglasses. I mean, it's all over the place. I love fun socks, particularly at the Business Journal. I don't want to call it like a stuffy button-down place, but the dress code was a little bit more, collar, wear your slacks, not don't wear too loud of a shirt. But always was able to kick it out.
You can always mix it up with the socks.
With the socks, you can always mix it up. So I've now built out a decent little sock repertoire, if I do say so.
I've seen at the legislature a couple of times, the ice has been broken in committee meetings at the press conference room when a lawmaker has remarked about reporters' socks. Specifically, and I'll give him a shout out here, Mark Binker of WRAL, strong sock game. And I think it's kind of influenced the press corps at the legislature. I'm wearing Larry Bird socks at the moment. I happened to wear them
Larry Legend
when I got married. So sock game is very important.
It is.
We'll bring the mirror out, or what? I don't know if that's the best word for it. You got any questions for me?
Questions for you? Man, that's a great question. Well, what do you see in this election? I've done a lot of talking about it. What do you see here in this election, either at the top of the ticket, Attorney General's race that's not getting a ton of attention? There's Burr Ross out there. That's a very important one, but has been getting, very little press.
It's fascinating. I hearken back to some of the stories that I've reported on. Specifically to that, because you just mentioned it. I think it's really interesting, and I'm to blame, we're all to blame to some extent. The Burr Ross race, there's been such little conversation about the Supreme Court. That's one of the biggest functions of the U.S. Senate, right? And there's already a vacancy. It's possible there will be one, two, or maybe three more in the years to come. Whoever wins that race might have an influence, a significant hand in the shape, the lean of the court for 25 or 30 years. I think that's significant. One more minor nuance thing, and this is more me giving myself a plug, but I did a couple of stories on a vacancy, a federal court vacancy in the Eastern District of North Carolina, which is just kind of noteworthy because it's been a vacancy for almost 11 years now. And Richard Burr has, for several different reasons, but he has not allowed the nominee to move forward. So that's one thing that could change if Deborah Ross is elected at this point. I think it's also pretty interesting that we're talking about Richard Burr potentially losing, right? Like he's 22 years in Congress. It's rare to unseat an incumbent. And this is an incumbent who has two terms in the Senate and five in the House. Like, that's pretty surprising.
He's strong.
I think, and I'm rambling a bit here per usual, I think that the Attorney General's race is interesting to me. I think both of those candidates, Republican Buck Newton and Josh Stein, both out of the state Senate, I think they both have an eye on the executive mansion. I think that they both, if if either wins, I think you're looking at a possible, depending on how the governor's race goes, I think you're looking at a possible candidate come 2020 or 2024. But these are both guys who I think, you know, have some prominence after some sessions in the
AG's
Senate,
office is the new stepping stone to the governor's mansion. Is that what we're saying?
I don't know. Maybe. you and I are millennials, so I really can't speak to this too much. But one thing that I've heard from a number of strategists and political scientists and even reporters who are old enough to be our mom or dad, they talk about Roy Cooper as really being the last of this breed of politician, and that North Carolina has seen a lot of these down east rural Democrats over the years. Mm-hmm. If you go back 50, 60 years, and there just aren't any like that anymore. I mean, you look at the rural districts and they're by and large overwhelmingly Republican. So win or lose, and I don't really know if that's of that much interest to people, but Roy Cooper is essentially the last in a brand of politician that for a long time had a real role in North Carolina.
Yeah, and Josh is definitely, I mean, he's a little bit more of a city guy, Josh Stein.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's
Ivy League educated.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, he's been hammered on Twitter for that.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, he's not a down east
kind of guy.
Agricultural kind of guy.
Yeah,
no
question.
All right. We'll end it there. Jason DeBruin, data reporter for WUNC. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Hope to do it again.
Share this episode on Twitter and or Facebook. Subscribe to the WUNC Politics podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And of course, stay up to date with political news at our website, WUNC.org. Feel free to reach out and tell us about your sock game as well. I'm Jeff Tiberi. We'll talk to you soon. And the children age, and the love we share.